Meet Reed Lance Rosenthal, rancher, number one best-selling award-winning author, and unabashedly, unapologetically, on the right side of the outstanding issues of our generation. But don't try to fence him in. Sometimes his positions will surprise you, because Reed is definitely his own man, with his own opinions. You might love him, you might hate him, but you won't be able to stop listening. Step over to the right side with Reed.
Good morning. It is On the Right Side Radio, Saturday. And what is it, September 25th? 23rd? I've lost track of time. Anyway, it's that Saturday of that weekend, 2017. I have quite a show for you this morning. It's early morning again on the ranch. A gentle rain coming down, the threat of snow. Definitely fall. Kind of nice. Hay is all stacked and ready to be loaded to the folks that are buying it. And I'm going to start off with a story today. And this is from St. Martin, which was, as you know, ravaged by Hurricane Irma. I talked about it on the last few shows. And now poor Puerto Rico has gotten hammered by Maria. Total wreck. I mean, these people need our help. Don't forget about Houston. Don't forget about Florida and the Keys. I mean, it's just a bunch of stuff, and we need to help. I'm also going to be talking this morning about incredible kind of insight into the progressive mindset in their questioning of an appeals court judge nominee by Trump. I'm going to be talking about the border wall and the fact that the nonsense that the progressives throw up about how it's too expensive. Oh, yeah, okay, this is after spending $10 trillion in the last 8 years for nothing. How it's too expensive and how it won't work. And how we can just use technological advances. How that's a bunch of nonsense. I'm going to give you two specific examples on the planet Earth that shows walls do work, which is exactly why they don't want a wall. And we're going to be talking about this unmasking deal, which is resurfaced now with a vengeance. Rice, Powers, Rush Limbaugh kind of caught it the other day and said finally, and it's the first time I've heard it, what I've been saying for almost a year, and that is, this is A, on purpose, B, Powers is the wife of Cass Sunstein, Obama's former regulatory czar. They are both dyed-in-the-wool to the left of progressive progressives. So we're going to be talking about that because that's a really big deal. That's probably the biggest scandal deal going in D.C. right now amidst a bunch of scandal deals. We're going to be talking about the dangers of Google. And this is something I've been meaning to talk about the last few weeks. Other news has kind of pushed it off the radio show docket. But you really need to know how powerful and how potent and how left and how controlling this company is. Because it affects your life. It affects your information. And it affects, really, the policy of the world. And it does so blatantly. Blatantly. We're going to be talking a little bit about North Korea, and then finally, I'm going to give you my long-promised show on the fiscal health of the various states, and I think you'll find some of those numbers, particularly as it relates to your own state, rather, in some cases, amazing, in some cases, alarming, in some cases, downright appalling. So, let's get started. First of all, I'm going to read you a letter from a friend of ours on St. Martin. And I think this will bring home to you, it's poignant. And this is a pretty well-to-do person. I mean, this is not somebody who was living in a hovel. He had first-class quarters, first-class construction, first-class life, and it has been relegated to rubble. I'll let his letter speak for himself. Sunday. Shoes. The days start early, run long and end abruptly. Sunrise wakes you. Sunset brings you close to where you will sleep, and by 9 p.m. or so, fatigue is you snoring. The tropical day is just over 12 hours at this time of year and varies little from season to season. September is the warmest month. The seas warm up, making them into more effective hurricane generators. It also makes for high humidity and consistent daytime temperatures well into the 90s. Sunday was the quietest day since Irma dropped in. The frenetic activity slowed, allowing all to reflect. The churches overflowed, and there was much sorrow and joy. Some of our little community of survivors make their first visits to where their homes once were. A few were pleasantly surprised at the relative damage, and others were not, with entire homes gone, scraped to the foundation. But all were alive and thankful. Here at the club, I spent a couple of hours in what was our bedroom, now more a platform with a spectacular view of Creole Rock and Anguilla beyond. So stunning it draws the eyes away from the destruction of things man-made and reminds you that it is nature that is eternal. With a rock hammer, I break the concrete and block wall that has fallen on my closet, looking to retrieve a pair of shoes. My feet have been abused since the storm. I escaped only with a pair of shorts on and my wife with her nightshirt and one sandal. As the storm passed, I stepped on a big nail that went through my right foot and snagged my left big toe on a jagged bit of metal roofing. Navigating anywhere is a risky task given the amount of dangerous debris. I am lucky to have been so slightly injured, but your feet, they are more crucial to you than ever in these times, hence the search for some shoes. We have been on the island for 20 years, bringing up our boys from ages 5 and 10 until they left for school and their own lives abroad. But our apartment was filled with all that we had lived through. Those years, as well as what we had brought with us and what we had accumulated. We were cluttered, to say the least, and do a good clean out, but did not expect it to be as complete as it turned out. Everything we ever had was blown out into the grounds, buried under fallen walls and roofs, and then watered by the accompanying rains. All the electronic gadgets I so enjoyed, destroyed. All our family records, spun by the tempest and thrown to the four winds. Walking the property, I discovered a photo, a document, a reminder of times before. Staff come and give me a Costco membership card with my name on it, a bit of jewelry or an item they know is ours. With most of these discoveries, I thank them and smile, as so little has so much value. Yet all are priceless. Many of these things were long ago forgotten, and it took a hurricane to dredge them up. But once in a while, treasures are found, and they bring a tear and a heavy heart to see what seems so important relegated to a pile of trash. Back to the job at hand, whacking away at the fallen concrete, which finally buckles, cracking and breaking. Between sneaking looks at the view and the beauty around me, I notice some shoes, seeing the first light of day for over a week. Carefully, like an archaeologist, I brush them free. Some are already mold-covered and filled with fiberglass insulation remains, sheetrock, muck, and other unknown materials. But I find a couple of pair that will be more than useful once cleaned up and washed. I have struck treasure, and it has made my day. Tomorrow, I'll have shoes again, if my swollen feet will allow it. Now, I wonder, where will I find some socks? You know, I can preach and prattle about the destruction of these storms. This letter really is eloquent, but could have been written by anyone in a dozen locations around the Caribbean and Florida, because they are all facing the same horrendous plight. And now Puerto Rico, without power, they project for months, flash flooding. I think yesterday evening I heard that some of the dams and levees are breaking on the island, and people are being told to get to high ground. I mean, this is a wreck, folks. So, by all means, kind of give some money. Red Cross, or, as I recommended, I believe, in last week's show, find an outfit that is matching contributions by a 2 or 3 to 1 margin and maximize your $50 gift to $100 or $150 or $200. I mean, these folks really need help. Now, onto the events of the week. First of all, there's a Senate hearing on a judge that's been nominated to the appeals court. She's conservative and she's Catholic. And you know, the questions that she was asked, by the way, the Republicans sit there spineless. Understand that there are hundreds of judicial nominees that Trump has made that the Republican Senate, let me repeat that, the Republican Senate has not seen fit to get approved. I mean, we have a once-in-a-generation chance to shape the judiciary for the next 40 years, and these people are spineless. So in the course of the questioning of this judge, whose credentials, by the way, are extraordinary, Dianne Feinstein starts talking to her about a speech she made that had religious overtones and how religion just can't play into the workings of a court. And it seems impossible to her that this judge would be unbiased if seated on the appeals court because she would give everything a religious overtone. And then Al Franken, that creep who fraudulently won by 300 felon votes, his senator's seat, he pipes in and he starts asking her questions like, you can't make these up. Are you an Orthodox Catholic? So I guess now the progressive left is out of the closet on what they think of religion and God and faith in a higher being, which also kind of drifts you over to the Constitution, which I've talked about in the last few shows. Google up Constitution, and you will see a number of shows. Listen to the last several, because progressives hate the Constitution. Hate it. It is merely a covenant of negative rights, as Barack Obama has said, Cass Sunstein has said, and Susan Powers has intimated. And you know, in the Constitution, our rights and our freedoms are given to us not by government, but by our Creator. So you will have to think about the ideology of a Franken and a Feinstein and the rest of the progressive morons. You'll have to think about their ideology as it pertains to your liberties. Because in their mind, your liberties, folks, come from government. And your liberties are a privilege that government, once freed from the shackles of its negative covenants of the Constitution, can do away with, subvert, award to the highest bidder, or give to friends and keep from foes. Kind of like the justice system, you know, where certain people are singled out, targeted, investigated, and indicted, and other people with crimes that stare you in the face, like Hillary Clinton, Susan Powers, Amantha Powers, Susan Rice, Ben Rhodes, Barack Obama, Valerie Jarrett, where they get off scot-free. I don't know about you, but it really pissed me off. It is subversion of the country. The rule of law, the Constitution, and equal law for all. It is a subversion of the rule of law. And it's intentional. It's not an accident. So, moving along in our progressive bent here, the progressives, of course, have abandoned the middle class of America and the working class of America. They couldn't care less about us. They couldn't care less about Bubba, the flyover states, the red states, or anyone but the populated centers on the coasts. They really couldn't care less. In fact, they loathe us. They loathe our adherence to American values. They loathe our love of the Constitution and our willingness to defend it in our own ways. They loathe it. And the Democratic Party, which is no longer the Democratic Party, the Progressive Party, has determined, and I'm quite convinced of this, that they're not going to pay attention to the middle class, to the white folks that they castigate all the time to what they consider to be the ruling class, although they themselves are the elite ruling class. No, the hell with us. What they want to do is establish a new electorate through illegal and legal immigration any way they can do it. And hence their opposition to the wall. Because they know in their heart of hearts that a wall is permanent. That it can't be undone with the illegal stroke of a pen by the next Democratic president. That another Barack Obama can't do a DACA deal. Because a wall, when built, is built. It's there. Now, I suppose the next Democratic president could say, don't man it. But nonetheless, it's a physical impediment to travel and illegal immigration. To give you an example of how feckless their arguments are that a wall doesn't work, let me give you two examples on the planet Earth just in the last 5 years. Number one, Israel. So Israel built a wall to keep out Palestinian terrorists. And yes, there are occasional breaches of the wall, occasional tunnels under the wall, and occasional criminal terrorists, radical Islamists, you know, work like a insect through the mesh of the wall and get in and do damage. But this is an amazing statistic. The amount of infiltration and terror committed by that particular group whom was directly targeted by the wall in Israel is down 98.7% since the wall's construction. Let me repeat that. Infiltrations by radical Islamist terrorists from the Palestinian territory is down 98.7% since the wall was constructed in the last few years. You think that's an anomaly? You think that's just kind of a, you know, gee, they got lucky? Let me give you another one. Just in the last 5 years. Hungary, a European country, one of the few that said absolutely no way to all this immigration, refugee flow, et cetera, that the rest of Europe has allowed itself to be inundated with, to its horrific detriment and to the peril of its women and the rest of its population, as manifested by terror attack after terror attack after terror attack, by thousands, if not tens of thousands, of rapes. The globalists in Europe have been shown a thing or two by Hungary. Let me give you the stats on Hungary's wall, which was erected specifically in the last several years to not allow refugees or any immigration into Hungary other than what Hungary allowed. In 2015, 391,000 refugees and illegal immigrants poured into Hungary. 2015. Hungary went nuts. The population went nuts. They built the wall. And in 2016, that 391,000 number went down to 18,236 and has further dropped since completion of the wall late last year, 2016, to in 2017 so far, 1,184. This, folks, is a 99% effective rate on the Hungarian wall. So you take Israel's wall with a 98.7 effectivity and Hungary's wall with a 99% effectivity, and you tell me if a wall on the southern border would not make a difference for the United States of America. And, of course, the mainstream media doesn't talk about this at all, because, you know, they're on board with the progressives for free and unfettered borders. Because they're on board with the progressives for a whole new electorate that makes the American middle class and working class irrelevant. Which, by the way, in their minds, we already are. By the way, the Prime Minister of Hungary, his name is Viktor Orban. He was told by the European Union that he couldn't put up the wall. He said, screw you, and built the wall anyway. Then he doubled the size of the wall. That's that decrease from 18,000 to, 1,800 or 1,100 this year. And then he sent, you'll love this, he sent a bill for half the cost of the wall to the European Union. You know, I like this guy. It's kind of the Trump of Hungary, right? And then Angela Merkel, decrepit globalist that she is of Germany, she got all over him for defying the edicts of the European Union and the faceless bureaucrats and globalists in Brussels. And Victor goes on TV, he goes, hey, you know, thank you, Andrea. Appreciate your input. And tyrants have been trying to tell us what to do for years, and we're done listening. You know, Hungary is a sovereign state. We're going to remain that way. Hungary first. And I should have had my sell-off, but I don't. But I do now. My apologies, audience. So that's the effective rate of walls that are properly constructed on borders. They do work. And the cost, if you'd like to put in the search bar, cost of immigration or cost of illegal immigration, I'm pretty sure the shows will pop up. I've done several that will tell you the actual cost nationally and on a state-by-state basis of illegal immigration. In the tens and tens of billions of dollars. This wall, even if it costs $25 billion, and it won't, even if Mexico didn't pay a penny, and it will pay all of it, Trump will make sure of it one way or the other, will get reimbursed. This wall will pay for itself in a half a year. A half a year. That's how cost-effective this wall is, and that's how effective it is in stopping physical human traffic, which is exactly why the progressives don't want it. You know, all the technical stuff they want can be turned off at the flip of a switch by an executive order from a Democratic, actually progressive, president. That's what they want. Okay. The next thing we're going to talk about is North Korea. So North Korea, here's my personal opinion. I have said this. I am so sick and tired of listening to people on the radio, on TV, all these pundits wringing their hands. Oh, my God, we can't exercise military option, and all these people will die, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And you'll see, I think, under international, an article I posted by a general as to what the casualty effects of a North Korean conflict might be, assuming a swift and overwhelming strike by the United States. While still horrific, I will remind you that this is a zero-sum game. If you think that the casualties taking out North Korea now would be horrific, you wait until they can try and exercise extortionist dominance over the Pacific and South Korea. You wait until they have not just 60 nukes in storage that they can launch one or two of them like right now, but until they have 60 or 100 or 150 nukes in storage and they can launch all of them. You ain't seen nothing yet. And with that kind of nuclear umbrella, do you really think that North Korea, who has said time and time and time again that its goal is to conquer South Korea, I am just not doing my phones too good here, am I? Do you really think that the these phones are just such a pain in the butt? About half the time, I forget to turn them off. In any event, Do you really think North Korea, with a nuclear umbrella like that, I mean a true nuclear umbrella, not, you know, the couple of missiles that might reach the United States or Japan with a couple of miniaturized warheads and one or two hydrogen bombs, do you think a North Korea with 200 nukes on 200 missiles that they could launch more or less simultaneously at a dozen different targets? What do you think our stance should be when they invade with ground forces South Korea under the ruse of that, not the ruse, under the nuclear umbrella that I'm describing? And that is where they're headed. If you think that a bloody conflict would ensue now with a preemptive strike by the United States, you ain't seen nothing yet if we don't do it. I'm here to tell you that conflict with North Korea is inevitable. The only thing we can choose is how it begins and when it begins. And the longer we wait, every day that we wait, more people are going to die. And the harsh reality is that some people will die by acting early, but far less than by continuing the outrageous, laissez-faire, almost treasonous stance towards North Korea of Bill Clinton, to a lesser extent of Bush, and absolutely by Barack Obama, Powers, Rice, and that whole progressive crew. North Korea has to go. And in taking out North Korea, you are sending a message to Iran. And maybe, just maybe, you can get the Iran deal redone. You can denuclearize them rather than allowing them to be in a status, as Obama did, fully funded and ready and able under his agreement to build an armada of nukes now 7 years from now, 10 years from when the deal was done. And you can nip that problem in the bud. Bottom line is, you want to fight two problems down the road that you're absolutely going to have to fight. These people have told you you're going to have to fight. Or do you want to take care of it now, despite the fact it's going to create anguish, chaos, and loss of life, but at a far, far, far lesser degree than if we wait? All right. This North Korea thing is very... I just shake my head. You know, have we learned nothing from history? Nothing? Appeasers get punched in the face, period. And there's far more damage done. I mean, the most recent major appeasement was Neville Chamberlain, the Prime Minister of Britain, basically giving Adolf Hitler Czechoslovakia in 1938/1939 to try and buy peace. Germany said thanks and invaded Poland in World War II. 100 million lives lost. God knows what suffering, anguish, destruction. World War II was on the way. In fact, giving Hitler Czechoslovakia was the precipitator of World War II. Because Hitler figured he could work against the Allies with impunity. They would do nothing. This is the same mentality we're now facing because we've trained them for 25 years in both North Korea and Iran. The cycle has to stop. And the lessons that go out to the world from stopping the cycle when it should be stopped, albeit 25 years late, and no longer waiting and hoping that sanctions, which aren't going to do squat. I don't care if the Chinese banks don't send them a yuan. I don't care if Russia doesn't send them any oil. I mean, I don't care. These guys are on a path. They're not going to deviate. They've told you they're not going to deviate. And for 25 years, they have demonstrated they're not going to deviate. Over the last 6 months, they have 10X demonstrated they're not going to deviate despite turning the screws on them. It's time to act. The time for talk is over. And if we don't, we have an atrocious set of events coming in our future, or our children's future, one or the other, maybe both. So, Rice, let's talk about unmasking. So we now learn that Powers, the ambassador at the United Nations, the Democrats are scurrying around saying, oh, she was on the National Security Council, so, you know, she had to know, and there's a lot of bad actors at the United Nations, and, you know, what, all this crap. Here's the bottom line. John Bolton, in 8 years as the ambassador to the United Nations, unmasked American names on 10 occasions. In the 9 months leading up to and directly after, the several months leading up to the inauguration, this last year, 2016-17, Ms. Powers, married to Cass Sunstein, ultra-progressive and good buddy of Barack Obama, and appointed by Barack Obama, and working in concert with Susan Rice, who unmasked more people, and Ben Rhodes, who unmasked more people, unmasked 260 American names. Almost one a day. Now, up to that time, I don't have the exact figures. I believe she had unmasked 22 in her tenure as ambassador at the United Nations. Still a rather high rate. And you know, of the 260 names that she unmasked, every single one, that's right, no exceptions, every single one was, in some way, shape, or form, related directly or indirectly to Trump, the campaign, or the incoming administration, since many of these unmaskings occurred after Trump's election and before his inauguration. And isn't it odd that much of the information associated with the transcripts in which these American names were illegally, feloniously, and treasonously unmasked has been or is being leaked by various intelligence services? And, you know, ensnared in this whole web of lies that is now collapsing, I mean, literally over the last few days, is Mr. Comey, who testified before Congress that there was no wiretapping of Trump Tower, except that we've learned over the last week that, in fact, Trump Tower was wiretapped, specifically Manafort, who both worked at Trump Tower and had his apartment at Trump Tower. And you're telling me that Manafort's conversations with candidate Trump or President-elect Trump were not wiretapped? Are you trying to tell me that a wiretap into Trump Tower is not a wiretap of Trump Tower? Bottom line is, Trump's tweet of March 4th, Trump Tower wiretap by Obama, is exactly correct. Remember all the crap he got. And what else is exactly correct is that Jeff Sessions needs to get on the ball, if he hasn't already, and launch a full investigation of all these people. Appoint a special prosecutor related to the unmasking, the leaks, that whole conundrum, that ball of nasty wax. And some people need to go to jail for a long, long time. It's kind of like North Korea. If you don't send the message now, it's only going to get worse in the future. And the security of me and you and our families and America is at stake. But remember, progressives don't care about America or me or you or our children. They care about their ideology. And they hate the Constitution. And the unmasking of these names, which is a direct abridgment of Fourth Amendment rights, is a poke in the eye of the Constitution. If unpunished, never mind equal law for all and all that happy stuff. If it's left unpunished, it will weaken the Constitution, which, by the way, is a byproduct goal of theirs. The primary goal is to try and stop Trump's agenda, which is anti-progressive. In other words, contrary to their ideology. Which brings me to a side note, and that's the current healthcare bill, if you will. Obamacare. I don't want to call it a repeal bill because it's not really. What it really does is takes Obamacare, divvies up all the money that was allocated to Obamacare and ships it out to the states, and each state can figure out what it wants to do with it. Not a perfect bill, but it's a hell of a lot better than the federal government trying to run health care. The progressives have been brought out of the closet once again. Obamacare was designed to fail. Go back to my Obamacare shows 4, 5, 6 years ago. Type in Obamacare. Listen to some of them. And when it failed, it was designed to be replaced by a single-payer system, just like Bernie's calling for now, and many of the progressives are calling for now. Just like California is trying to institute now on a statewide basis, along with several other blue progressive states. That is the end goal here. More government control, less individual freedom. Shipping this money out to the states does not disband Obamacare. It fractionalizes it into 50 pieces and gives control of those 50 pieces to the 50 states. And it is a death spike in the heart of the progressives' long-held dream of a single-payer system. Which makes John McCain's, as of yesterday, sudden opposition to this bill and his mealy-mouthed, rhino, progressive, globalist, anti-American, anti-Arizona prattle about why he's not going to vote for it make me wretch. I mean, I am so over John McCain and the rest of these rhinos, I can't even begin to tell you. With his own governor in Arizona exhorting him to vote for it, with the people in his state paying 116% premium increases, with the goals of the progressives to institute a single-payer system on a national basis, which would be 10 times worse than Obamacare, which is horrible, McCain's going to vote no. And what you need to know is that this is the last vote before September 30th. And after September 30th, you need 60 votes to get anything done on this, which is going to be impossible with the progressives, not the Democrats, because there are no more, the progressives who call themselves Democrats in the Senate. And McCain has the gumption, the cojones, to say that it should be done in the normal rule of order. And it should be done on a bipartisan basis, knowing full well there is no bipartisan basis whatsoever to get this bill done. The Democrats will never in a million years allow federal control to be shipped out to the states. And the progressives will never in a million years allow their finger hold on a single-payer national system to evaporate before their eyes. John McCain makes me wretch. You folks in Maine who have Susan Collins as a senator, whose governor has also told her to please vote for the bill, and you folks in Kentucky that have Rand Paul as a senator, I realize he's standing on principle, but, you know, sometimes you have to slightly subvert your principle for a short period of time to achieve your principle in the end. That old Irish saying, so Marshal Fox retreated with 30,000 men to turn and meet the foe again. Very apt in this circumstance. You folks need to write, call, and absolutely get on the horn to Susan Collins and Paul Rand. And you folks up in Alaska, I'm going to be talking about you here in a moment. Lisa Murkowski, you folks up there in Alaska, you have one insurance outfit left. It won't even service some of your counties and your counties are huge and far-flung and remote, and you're looking at 100% increases in your premiums, and Lisa Murkowski doesn't know she's a yes for this, does she really believe the federal government can do a better job in Alaska? Does McCain believe the federal government can do a better job in Arizona? Does Collins believe the federal government can do a better job in Maine than the governments of those states putting together the healthcare system for their own populations in their very specific and quite different geographic locations with entirely different economies and needs? Really? Please. All these people need to go away. But in the meantime, they need to vote for this bill. It's one step in the right direction. And if you don't take this one step, you may never be able to take a step. In fact, you may be taking a step backwards into a single-payer national system, which would be a friggin' disaster. If you think you have problems right now, listeners, getting coverage, having doctors accept Obamacare, arguing with the Obamacare bureaucrats, if you're a male paying for maternity stuff, if you are an elderly woman paying for prenatal care, if you have problems with those mandates now, which are jacking up your rates and creating policies which are useless, you wait until there's a single-payer system and somebody can determine if you live or die. You have no idea how bad this could get. John McCain does. He doesn't care. He's a progressive globalist that happens to have an R in front of his name. Lisa Murkowski, I don't know where her head's at, particularly as a woman. Susan Collins, she's all about Susan Collins. She wants to run for governor of Maine. She doesn't want to alienate part of the population up there. It just absolutely makes me wretch. Absolutely makes me wretch. And these smartphones are smarter than I am because I thought I turned it off, but obviously I did not. Okay, let's talk about Google. I'm not sure you understand, folks, and this is all part of the anti-constitution, progressive tendrils and nasty tentacles that are stuck into every thread of American society, that are woven into the fabric of American life because we were asleep at the switch. Google is immensely powerful. It controls information. How many times on this show have I said, if you control words, you control thoughts. If you control thoughts, you control perceptions. And if you control perceptions, you control actions. Google knows this. Let me give you some background on Google. This will flat frighten the hell out of you. There's a deal called the Open Markets Initiative. It was started by a guy by the name of Barry Lynn, who wrote a book, by the way, The End of the Line. Very worthwhile reading. And it's about the rise and coming fall of global corporations. He talks about Amazon, who dominates online books and products, and says that Amazon is so powerful it could, quote, exercise control over the marketplace of ideas in ways that threaten not merely open markets, but free speech itself. In August, even the New York Times took up the cry. And I'm not talking about Amazon today. I'm talking about Google, because the power and control that Lynn talks about that has accumulated in and been vested in Amazon, Google is 10x. It's 100x. You have no idea. Wait till you listen to this stuff. So the European antitrust regulators are kind of on to Google. And they slapped a $2.7 billion fine on it. That was in June, folks. June. The New America Foundation put all these dots together. New America Foundation gets $21 million from Google. Its parent company's executive chairman, Eric Schmidt, and his family's foundation also contribute to this think tank, which was founded in 1999. The press has realized, or should we say, helped catapult, because they are lefties, New America as the elite voice in policy debates on the American left. One of New America's scholars put a statement on the think tank's website that praised the European Union's penalty against Google. Schmidt, who had been the chairman of New America until 2016, expressed his displeasure to the new president of Google's think tank. Her name is Anne Marie Slaughter. And she dismissed this guy, whose name was Barry Lynn. Same Barry Lynn I've been talking about. And his entire 10-person staff. Lynn's comment, quote, "Google is very aggressive in throwing its money around Washington and Brussels and then pulling the strings. People are so afraid of Google now. That they hesitate to speak or act because of possible retribution." My producer is gesturing at me. No, I'm not going to bring people down the weeds. I'm giving you all some background as to how this stuff has been exposed. You call it inside Google whistleblowers. How's that? The New York Times, did you know that Google, in addition to pulling the strings with its own employees, and you've heard something about that, I believe, in the last month or so. Google is also like one of the, if not the top, lobbying firms in Washington, D.C. and Brussels, spending more than almost any other outfit. The New York Times says Google helped organize conferences at which key regulators overseeing investigations into the company were presented with pro-Google arguments, sometimes without disclosure of Google's role. Among the most effective, if little examined, tools in Google's public policy toolbox has been its funding of nonprofit groups from across the political spectrum. This year it's donated to 170 such groups, according to Google's voluntary disclosures on Google's website. By the way, there's another nonprofit outfit called the Electronic Frontier Foundation who agrees completely with the Times. So you have a few dominant internet players, Google the foremost by far, Amazon right behind it, that can control policy and thought and information. By the way, Google's parent firm is called Alphabet, Inc. Keep that in mind. It was originally founded in 1996. That's not so long ago, folks, 21 years ago, by Stanford researchers Sergey Brin and Larry Page. And was originally based, very simply, on the premise of using page ranking technology to order results on the relevance of market, that cell phone, I think I'm going to shoot it, on the relevance of people's searches. In other words, the newer the stuff, the higher the ranking, the more it's searched, the higher the ranking, et cetera, et cetera. Unfortunately, they lost control of the company. And progressives, and I'm being kind, took over. And very rapidly, the other search engine competitors, AltaVista, Excite, Yahoo, InfoSeek, others, you know the names. These outfits are now corporate shells. Google has decimated them. Decimated them. Google can and does, This is key. Google can and does dictate to business any policy it wants, I'm quoting, in regards to hoops that the company says firms must jump through in order to have their pages rank highly in search results. Now, I think you're all familiar if you're in business, and some of you who are not in business, but employees or contractors or whatever, may have heard about people who help you obtain search rankings. SEO. SEO, folks. SEO contractors. Well, Google has now made this labyrinth of control of information. This is not labyrinth of ranking now. This is the hoops you must jump through to get your information out there because Google thinks it's okay. So complex that very few firms other than the largest can afford these types of consultants. This will give you an idea of how far-reaching Google is, how much control it exerts. Let me give you a list of the things, the devices, the programs that Google exercises, let me repeat this, 100% control over. Smartphones and tablets, anything with Android, video, because they bought YouTube, web browsing via the Chrome browser on most computers, email, as in Gmail, mapping, Google Maps and Google Earth, internet advertising, AdWords and AdSense, which they also bought, website performance, Google Analytics, productivity applications, Google Docs, online storage, Google Drive, social media, Google Plus, payments, Google Wallet, language translation, Google Translate, vintage books, Google Books, shopping, Google Shopping, travel, Google Flights, music, Google Play, online discussions, Google Groups, instant messaging, Allo and Hangouts, voice over IP telephony, I probably mispronounced that, Google Voice, and video chatting, Duo. In addition, folks, Google has bought or developed the following. DoubleClick, AdMob, that's online advertising, restaurant reviews via its purchase of Zagat, that's Zagat, blogging via Blogger, virtual reality headsets via Google Glass, coupons via Daily Deal, robotics via Boston Dynamics, and home automation via Nest Labs. Google itself, folks, is the number one most visited site on the web, and you can well understand why. Because if you go to any of these outfits, places, devices that I've named, you are one way, shape, or form visiting Google. I want you to know that because of this, Google collects and stores all your personal data. Often, Google mines it and sells it to advertisers. You ever wonder why you look at a pair of boots on XYZ website, and the next time you kind of turn on the computer, you got 10 ads for boots? Thank Google. And by the way, this is done without the knowledge of the people that it's mining, whose information it's mining and whose information it's selling. These various professional outfits that are monitoring this, they estimate that in terms of the amount of data per individual between all the Google sites and properties, the company probably has about 50 pages of data per person. How much money you make, how much money is in your bank account, the names of your children, the names of your spouse, the addresses of where you live, phone numbers, social security numbers, recent purchases, recent Google searches through any of its incredible spider web of outfits, devices, and companies that it's acquired. They also have your messages to friends and coworkers, any documents you've worked on, which videos you've watched, or digital copies of your Google voice calls and voicemails. So let's get back to Eric Schmidt. Remember I was telling you about Eric Schmidt, who was the chairman of Google and the chairman of Alphabet, and kind of ran their internal think tank, and who called Slaughter the new president and had her fire the 10 upstarts who would dare question Google policies. Eric Schmidt, it's always good to go back to the source because, you know, it's their words. It's kind of like when North Korea says they're going to nuke you. You can probably take them at their word. When Iran says they're going to kill the great Satan and the little Satan, you can probably take them at their words. Here's a progressive's progressive who controls more information than any other person on the planet. Period. Here's what he says. And this is regarding Google's thoughts on privacy. Quote, if you have something you don't want anyone to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place. If you really need that kind of privacy, the reality is that search engines, including Google, do retain this information for some time. And it's important, for example, that we are all subject in the United States to the Patriot Act. And it's possible that's all that information could be made available to authorities, unquote. Gee, what do you think this guy's opinion of the Constitution is? In 2007, there's another watchdog group called Privacy International, and they rated Google, this is 2007, it's 10 times worse now, as hostile to privacy. That's its lowest ranking, and the only major company ever to receive that ranking at all, much less in successive years. You know what Chairman Schmidt said when he got that dastardly ranking? Quote, in a world of asynchronous threats, it's too dangerous for there not to be some way to identify you. We need a verified name service for people. Governments will demand it. If I look at enough of your messaging and your location and use artificial intelligence, we can predict where you're going to go. Show us 14 photos of yourself and we can identify who you are. You think you don't have 14 photos of yourself on the internet? You've got Facebook photos. Are you feeling good yet, folks? Huh? Are you feeling good yet? Just this year, after buying YouTube, to control political thought and political information, this is where all this is going. Google's YouTube division, i.e. their purchase of YouTube, began demonetizing certain videos. In other words, they don't pay the video's creator based on the number of views. And its prerequisite for demonetizing was, quote, videos that contain politically sensitive content the company disagreed with. YouTube, i.e. Google's YouTube division, further stated, quote, the demonetization would affect videos with content that included controversial or sensitive subjects and events, including subjects related to war, political conflicts, natural disasters, and tragedies, even if graphic imagery isn't shown, unquote. Remember, folks, that YouTube is a private company, albeit owned by Google, which is a private, well, it's a public company, actually. But it could choose to make these videos, which, by the way, include only conservative viewpoint videos. Let me underline that. Only conservative viewpoint videos have been targeted. It could choose to make these videos totally unavailable. So this New America Foundation, let's go back to Eric Schmidt, the Google chairman, the head of the New America Foundation, the internal Google think tank, et cetera, that kicked these guys off for daring to question Google's tactics. He kicked out, through his continuing control of New America Foundation, an internal initiative which was called the Open Markets. open markets. The president of that group, of that initiative, appointed by Mr. Schmidt, by the way, his name is Jonathan Rothenberg. Let me read you what Mr. Rothenberg has written about the open initiative. Quote, "There are simply fewer groups that are available to speak up about Google's activities that threaten online privacy. The groups that are speaking up are not." I wonder why they aren't. Because your YouTube videos get delisted, you are banned from a number of sites, and Google drops your rankings on the search pages to somewhere around page 1,000. You think that's control of information, folks? Where is the First and Fourth Amendment in all this? Obviously, Mr. Schmidt, being a progressive, doesn't think much of either. Let me give you another quote. This is the founder of the antivirus company McAfee Associates, John McAfee. Quote, "Google is driving people to a lowest common denominator. The surveillance that Google's technology affords ultimately bodes ill for humanity. If everybody knew everything about everybody else, what would human behavior become? We would be limited to the least common denominator of human behavior, those behaviors which no one would find offensive." Gee, politically correct, the left, progressive, "We cannot have intrusions into our lives and still have freedom." How right he is. Now, I don't know what you do about this. You know, I like giving you a problem and then a solution, or at least a problem and then an idea, or at least connecting dots for you and telling you something that you can do. Other than not use Google, to go out of your way to use one of the other search engines, AOL, Yahoo, I mean, whatever, that Google does not control, I don't know at this point what you can do, but I'm going to research it, and I'll be back to you on it. Because this is a threat to our freedoms, it's a threat to our information, and it is a threat to both the globe and to America and the Constitution. This kind of power should not be concentrated in anyone's hands, government or private. All right, last but not least, my long-promised update to you about the states. Well, it will not surprise you when I give you the list of the best five states, or the most fiscally sound five states, and the most fiscally unsound 10 states. Because with only two exceptions, the best are red and the worst are blue. Gee, must be a coincidence, huh? First, though, as a little backdrop, I afforded you a show, it was four, five, six shows ago. You can type in the search bar, pension funds and unfunded liabilities. I gave you a show that told you just how bad the pension house of cards in the United States is, particularly public pensions, both federal and state. And how, in most cases, and they're already starting to surface, I gave you some specific examples. You should listen to them. They're horrifying. People who had counted on these pensions are not getting paid. Pensions are going bankrupt or being taken over. People's entire retirement plans are being turned upside down. A report that just came out September 14th from Moody's, remember the big credit rating agency? U.S. state, just the state, not the feds, not counties, not cities, just state, pension liabilities hit $1.3 trillion in fiscal 2016, which is a $56 billion or 4.5% increase over the previous fiscal year. That's huge, folks. I mean, think about those numbers. And they, as I told you in the previous shows, they attributed this to underperforming investment returns, optimistic projections, low interest rates, insufficient contributions, all the things I discussed in those previous shows, which I urge you to listen to, particularly if you are relying on a pension of any type from any government source whatsoever. Quote, this is from Moody's. About half the states are also not making sufficient payments to pension systems to prevent their unfunded liabilities from growing, even if investment targets are met, unquote. It projected that these unfunded liabilities, these pension liabilities, will grow to $1.7 billion, $400 billion increase in 2017. That's this year, folks. Listen to this. This leads right into where I'm going here with the state, the fiscal soundness of various states. Fiscal 2016's $1.3 trillion state pension unfunded, that is, there's no money to back it, unfunded liability equaled 122% of all states' revenue. Not only is it unfunded, it is more than the revenue the state brings in. Illinois, which was the subject of one of my shows, type in Illinois in the search bar. You can listen to it. I mean, it's unbelievable. Yet they managed to find $100 billion to build some kind of monument to Barack Obama. Illinois can't, because of its constitution, reduce retirement benefits to cut pension costs. Illinois is broke. It's broke operationally. It's broke in its pension system. It's broken in its education. It is broke. It is the worst of the worst, other than New Jersey, as I'm going to get to. Its unfunded liability in pensions in 2016 was 487%. That's 487% of its revenue. The median, by the way, for all states is 82%, which is horrible. 550% worse is Illinois. Alaska, by the way, hey, Lisa Murkowski. Alaska came in at second, 443% of revenue. And Connecticut, which has been run into the ground by a progressive state government and legislature, is at 285%. By the way, you people in North Carolina, you're in the best shape. You are only 23.6%. You are well covered. The Mercatus Center is kind of the noted authority for putting together reports and rankings of state fiscal health. I've been researching this for a while. I've been meaning to get you this segment for God knows how long. I think I promised it for the last 7 or 8 weeks. And I've had a bunch of emails saying, where is the state stuff? Well, here it is. With the lead in, by the way, on those pension deals, because they are a huge increment of state solvency. State fiscal rankings. You know, a fiscal ranking for a state is, it depends on many things. I mean, it's not just the amount of money they bring in and how much money they have, and it's pensions and all that kind of good stuff. It also includes its ability to attract businesses, how much taxes it gets, what services it provides, how well it keeps its promises to its public sector employees, i.e. pensions, as one example. So the Mercatus Center is at George Mason University. And they just published their report, well, not just, but July 11th, 2017, ranking the states by fiscal condition. This is the fourth year it's published this report. The folks who put this together for Mercatus is Eileen Norcross and Olivia Gonzalez. They do a really incredible job, absolutely nonpartisan. If there's a partisan thought in my presentation, I'm interjecting it. And they based, they pour through the state's financial statements, their audited financial statements, all their, I mean, they really do an unbelievable job. It is the most thorough investigation and compilation of state fiscal health done by anyone, anywhere. Nothing's even close. They also develop trend lines, by the way, which are very interesting. I'm not going to get into them today, but trend lines that identify structural. This is not cyclical, but structural. I mean, major problems that have to be fixed. You know, as an analogy, if a boat springs a leak and you can patch it, that's a problem. But if the boat's hull breaks in two, that's a structural problem. So, including pension liabilities, etc. I'm just going to give you a summary, because I don't want to lose you in the weeds. Hopefully I didn't with the Google stuff, because it's, boy, is that important and scary. And nobody's talking. I mean, nobody is talking about it. And once again, you know, these are one of these things. North Korea, Iran, Google, the state stuff. You can't believe how much I so hope I'm wrong. And unfortunately, I almost never am. I'm just a poor old hayseed from Wyoming, but 2 + 2 = 4 and water runs downhill, and that's just the way it is. So, anyway, this summary, which I think is maybe the best and most accurate statement of a state's health condition in this voluminous report, is based on 5 key indicators. Cash solvency. Does a state have enough money, cash, on hand to cover its short-term bills? The second criteria is budget solvency. Can a state cover its fiscal year spending with current revenues, or is it going to have a shortfall? Long-run solvency. Can a state meet its long-term spending commitments? Is there enough money do they have in reserve to cushion it from economic shocks or, you know, storms or long-term fiscal, I mean, anything, the unforeseen? Do they have a rainy day reserve, I guess is the way you'd sum it up. Service level solvency. Do they have some slack in reserve if they need to increase services because their citizens demand or need more services? And finally, trust fund solvency. And this goes back to healthcare and unfunded pensions. How large is your unfunded pension liability? How large is your unfunded healthcare liability? So the overall fiscal condition rank, if you take those 5 criteria, number 1, this is best, most solvent, has their act together, looking great, is Florida. Number 2 is North Dakota. Number 3 is South Dakota. Number 4 is Utah. Number 5 is Wyoming. The 12 that are the worst. And I'm going to give you the bottom 5. I'll separate them out. Is Arizona, Mississippi, Maine, Michigan, Connecticut, Rhode Island, New York, Vermont, New Mexico, West Virginia, California, Louisiana at number 44, Pennsylvania, Maryland at 46, Kentucky at 47, Massachusetts at 48. Illinois was actually edged out by New Jersey in this study. Illinois at 49 and 50, New Jersey. Good job, Mr. Christie. Anyway, some of these states have moved since the 2015-2016 study they did. Wyoming actually went down 2 positions. New York, believe it or not, actually moved up 5 positions, even though it still sucks. It doesn't suck as much. How's that? And the bottom 5 states, let's talk about them for a moment. Okay, Alaska and Nebraska, both dropped out of the top 5. And Florida and Utah moved into the top 5. The bottom 5 states, Maryland, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Illinois, and New Jersey. Kentucky is a red state. The other 4 are blue states. Mostly, they are in the bottom 5 because they don't have a lot of cash. They can't cover all their bills. They have huge debt obligations. And they are not prepared at all. There's no rainy day reserve fund for anything, recession, storms, you name it. The bottom five states changed a little bit. Kentucky's position went down. New York came out of the bottom five. Illinois, New Jersey improved slightly, but stay in the bottom five. And so does Massachusetts. They cite the major drivers of fiscal performance for states that contribute to these five benchmark, if you will, for ranking them. In this last year as being reporting of pension liabilities on the balance sheet, the federal government actually changed the way states have to report, drops in the price of oil, changes in tax policy, and budget cuts. The states that drop most significantly, even though they're not in the top five or the bottom five, over the last year, is Alaska, Colorado. By the way, Colorado comes up a lot, you folks. I know I got a lot of listeners in Colorado. It comes up a lot. Your state is in what's called a structural decline, according to Mercatus. As a result, no doubt, of your progressive state government and legislature, your sanctuary status for illegal immigrants for whom you pay, and your huge net in-migration, which is straining services. But Alaska, Colorado, Louisiana, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, and Texas all dropped more than five positions in overall ranking. Arkansas, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Maine, North Carolina, and Oregon improved up to five positions, but many of them are still like in the bottom 10. In terms of the amount of cash on hand, North Carolina and Oregon improved the most. Budget solvency, one of the five criteria. Arkansas, California, Connecticut, Hawaii, Indiana, Kentucky, Maine, Maryland, Missouri, New York, Oklahoma, Rhode Island, Tennessee, and Vermont improved their budget positions. Alabama, Alaska, Colorado, there's Colorado again, Iowa, Kansas, Mississippi, Nebraska, New Mexico, Ohio, South Carolina, Texas, Washington, and Wisconsin worsened in their budget solvency conditions. In terms of long-run solvency, that's just not this year's operating budget, but looking out over the long term, a more structural analysis. Florida, North Carolina, Oregon, Virginia, and Wisconsin improved their long-run solvency. Colorado, Maine, Indiana, Vermont, and West Virginia, once again, Colorado, folks, dropped in this area. Service-level solvency. Remember, that was the criteria where you have a kind of a rainy day fund in case your population demands or needs more public services. Alaska and Wisconsin improved significantly. Arizona and Iowa went downhill. Trust fund solvency, this is the pension and health care problems, particularly the pension problems, which I kind of gave you as a prelude to this segment. Only North Dakota, one state, improved significantly. Oregon, Vermont, and Wyoming each dropped pretty significantly in the trust fund solvency ranking. So the top states, that is the most fiscally sound states, are predominantly, we're talking about 80 to 90%, red states. The bottom 10 states are predominantly, once again, we're talking about 70 to 80% blue states. And what the Mercatus Institute says is that they don't talk about red or blue or whatever. They're totally apolitical. That's my insert into this. But listen to the criteria they give for a state increasing or decreasing its rank according to those five criteria. Quote, top-performing states tend to exhibit fiscal discipline in the form of having high levels of cash, maintaining revenues that exceed expenses, and keeping debt levels low relative to resident income. I guess if you have a lot of illegal alien residents who aren't, this is my insert, folks, a lot of illegal alien residents who aren't paying their fair share, you kind of blow it on one of those drivers. I assume that if you are trying to give freebies to everyone and taxing only a few, i.e. wealth redistribution, you're going to blow those drivers. And if you're spending all your money on all that assorted crap, all the freebies to buy votes, then I guess you're not going to have a lot of cash. And you're going to forfeit another one of those drivers. Anyway, I hope that this is... I try to keep it kind of out of the weeds for you, because there's... I mean, I could talk for five shows about all the unbelievable stats and statistics that they have. I believe that is posted on the show. I hope it is. And there are some links. You can actually read the study for yourself. But it's an eye-opener. And it kind of tells us what we already knew on a lot of different levels, does it not? I want to remind you to give some money to those poor folks, whether it's the Virgin Islands or the French Antilles like St. Martin or Puerto Rico or the Florida Keys or any of these places that have been ravaged by Irma or Maria or any of these storms. Give some money, folks. Your fellow Americans, your fellow humans need you. And if you can give a little bit to all, that's great. If you want to concentrate it on one, that's terrific. If you can find a fund and they're out there, you can Google it. No, don't Google it. I take that back. Yahoo it. AOL it. Do anything but Google it after today's show. But you can do a search. And you can find out some outfits and organizations. I know Walmart was doing it. I don't know if they still are. And several other outfits. Basically, if you put in a buck, they match it with two or three. That's really good bang for your donation buck. Might allow you to give to a number of these areas. And if worse comes to worse, give to the Red Cross. These folks really need some help. This is Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side Radio. You have a safe week.
Please remember, if you've missed any shows, just click on Show Archive and you'll find all of his shows. We look forward to seeing you here again next week for another episode of Reed Lance Rosenthal on the Right Side.